Welcome once again to our program, The Universal Call to Holiness, Wholeness, and Happiness, as delineated by Vatican Council II in his document, and so often repeated and re-echoed as John Paul II, the Pilgrim Pope, traveled across the many countries of the world trying to implement the new evangelization. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who is professor at John Paul II Catholic High of Religion and World History. I'm your guest, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus here at St. Patrick and 19th and Poplar, where the streets intersect with the beautiful green shamrock. Ron, welcome once again, and we've been talking about obstacles to the call to holiness or wholeness, and we got discussing quite a bit about suffering and redemptive suffering. So could we say a few things about suffering being redemptive, because that's we've been mentioning that many, many times as we've gone through this series.
Yes, evil causes a lot of suffering and sorrow and death and destruction in the world. And I've heard you say many times in sermons over the years that suffering can either make us bitter or better. We can either be resentful and spiteful, even hateful, because of our infirmities, or we can benefit them by offering them up to God. And it's especially beneficial and commendable to offer our sufferings to the Blessed Mother at the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, who will unite it to her own suffering and that of her Son Jesus, who in turn will offer it to God the Father Almighty. Of redemptive suffering, Father Jordan Aumann, who we've been quoting quite a bit in this series, one of the world's most prominent spiritual directors and spiritual theologians, he says, quote, "God accepts the suffering offered to him by a soul in grace for the salvation of another soul or for the sinners in general. It is impossible to measure the redemptive power of suffering offered to divine justice with a living faith and an ardent love through the wounds of Christ. When everything else fails, there is still recourse to suffering to obtain the salvation of a sinful world," end of quote.
I think that was the great message of Fatima to the three children, to pray and make sacrifices for sinners, because many souls go to hell for there's no one to pray and make sacrifices for them. And those three children, I think they were about 11, 10 and 9 years old, Francisco, Jacinta, and Lucy, really took very seriously the message from Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal in 1917 and began to do all sorts of little penances, give up drinking water when they were thirsty, and they gave their lunch away to some hungry shepherd children, and just a lot of little things.
Yeah, I believe little Francisco, didn't he tie a chain or something around his waist that would cause him some discomfort? And,
oh, I didn't know about that, but all kind of things like that, because they really took it very seriously that they wanted to help children, I mean other children and other souls, because they were given a vision of hell also. And you know, there's a great statement in Teresa of Lisieux's A Story of a Soul, where she's praying for a dying man who's been condemned, a murderer, and she pleaded with the Lord, "He's my first sinner, and he's going to death unrepentant." And she prayed and prayed to please give me a soul, and the newspaper said the next day he went to the scaffolding unrepentant, but as he was climbing the scaffolding, he reached down to the priest who had a crucifix, and he kissed the crucifix as a sign of repentance. And then Teresa of Lisieux thanked the Lord for giving her her first soul that she had sacrificed and prayed for. Forgot what, his name was Pranzini.
Pranzini.
And a well-known murderer in France. So that's redemptive suffering that children of Fatima were doing, Teresa of Lisieux was doing, what Father Jordan Aumann is talking about. What we do as individuals to make our own sufferings, healing for others, healing for ourselves, are redemptive, as the theological word is.
Well, we can offer our suffering in reparation for our own sins, of course. the sins of others, for the poor souls in purgatory, that is, you know, the church suffering, that Jesus will take them to heaven, for the conversion of sinners. That was the main theme of Fatima that you just mentioned a while ago. That's what our Blessed Mother asked for. In fact, she said if the world didn't convert, that there was going to be another great war, that the war that was presently going on was about to end, that is World War I, but there'd be another great war if the world didn't convert, which obviously it didn't.
And that was predicted in 1917.
Yes.
And then the World War of 1939, I guess, when Hitler invaded Poland, was that when the World War II officially began?
Yeah, I believe
began?
It was September 1939, of course, when that took place. But that, that for the conversion of sinners, that Jesus will lead them to heaven, for the poor of the world, especially the poorest of the poor, that somehow their needs will be satisfied, for the sick and the sorrowing on the world, that God will heal and console them, for the reverence of all human life from conception to natural death, and for the abandoned, abused, and the lonely of the world. And we could, you know, add many other topics to this that we could pray for and make sacrifices for. But our sacrifices on behalf of the needs of others will earn great merit for us and help fulfill the requirements to perform spiritual works of mercy for the love of our neighbor and the love of God, of course.
I remember when I was growing up and in grade school, little in grade school, third or fourth grade, I used to skin my knees and my mom wanted to put alcohol on them to keep it from getting infected. And I would say, oh, no, it's going to burn, it's going to burn. And she would say, well, offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory. That was a common statement in those days. And it's like Bishop Sheen had said, oh, we can give a blood transfusion to another person. We can give a kidney to another person. We can give our bodily help to another person, so we can also give spiritual help. We give them spiritual blood transfusions, and it's basically the same idea, offering up our prayers and sacrifices for the needs, spiritual needs of others. What about commenting on Jesus as the one who made suffering redemptive or healing? That's where we get the idea that we can suffer and bring good to others just like Jesus did. What about that?
Jesus gives infinite worth to suffering. He is the suffering servant who came into the world to suffer and die for mankind. He came into the world to sanctify suffering. Especially see Isaiah 52 and 53, where you find the suffering servant songs. His sacrifice made, in other words, suffering redemptive. In other words, he suffered and died, and his suffering and death paid for the damage, all the damage caused by original sin and all actual sin. We too can make our suffering redemptive when we offer it to God for the behalf of others. We Christians, in fact, have the duty to take up our crosses daily and follow in the footsteps of Jesus. There's simply no other way to get to heaven. And this means that we must embrace our suffering and unite it to his suffering. Why God permits the innocent to suffer is still a mystery. But Christians should consider it a privilege to be able to suffer for Jesus. He was the most perfect, most innocent person who ever lived. Yet he suffered more than any other person that has ever lived. All you have to do is go see the movie, The Passion, and that's probably a pretty accurate portrayal of the kind of suffering he did undergo. In fact, if anything else, even worse. As I used to describe it to my students, trying to really bring it home, that's pretty well how I used to describe it to them. There was a movie, Jesus of Nazareth, and a very good movie. And I used to tell the kids, you know, when Jesus was scourged at the pillar there, he had just a few little pink stripes on him. But I said, the kind of tough, terrible suffering and torture that he underwent would have, and I went on to describe it to him in some detail, because I knew quite a bit about you know, the kind of instruments of torture that the Romans used, and why they used crucifixion and scourging. And these were things, of course, that the Romans had outlawed, you know, for their own citizens. There were such terrible, terrible punishments. They were punishments for criminals, really bad criminals.
And it was really trying to terrify people.
Yes.
To keep within the Roman eagle's law. Okay.
Well, I might add that his suffering and death was the greatest injustice that was ever committed. Mary, Our Lady of Sorrows, did not deserve to suffer either. But next to her son, Jesus, she suffered more than any other human being in history, in the history of the world.
So you're saying that what the Church has continually taught us in what is called ascetical theology, how to apply to our daily lives the great truths of the faith that come through the Creed and the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is that one of the most important things we need to learn is how to offer our suffering along with Jesus, the most innocent person in the world who offered his sufferings. And then, of course, you referred to Mary. I guess you know that in our church, the seven windows in the back of St. Patrick's Church all reenact or repicture the seven sorrows of Mary. And we often talk in song and in discussion about how Mary was suffering along with Jesus because being his mother, carrying her always in her heart, that she was helping redeem the world too.
Well, I think the reason that she probably suffered or did suffer more than any other human being has ever suffered, next to, of course, her son Jesus, you have to measure it against her perfection. And Christ's perfection, of course, he being God, obviously, was absolutely, and in no way did he deserve even the slightest, you know, suffering. Certainly, and Mary was so perfect because she was full of grace, not because of anything inherent in herself, but because she was full of God, she was full of his grace, that she was so perfect, too, that she didn't deserve any kind of, even the slightest, a bit of suffering. In fact, she was the most perfect person that ever lived, next to her son, of course. And yet she's known as Our Lady of Sorrows because she suffered so much. She didn't deserve to suffer because she was free from original sin as well as actual sin. And suffering is a result of sin.
So this is one of the big question marks in history. Why do good people have bad things happen to them or suffer
yes.
a lot? And of course Jesus and his Holy Mother Mary are two of the most clear examples that the innocent suffer often even more than the wicked do.
I remember right after 9/11, at the time I was teaching kids religion in the middle school, there were, you know, obviously all the children were very upset, of course, but there were some that were more so than others. I mean, upset in the sense is that it tended to affect their faith to some extent. One in particular comes to mind, and she was very, why, you know, this whole question, why would a good God allow such an evil thing to happen to innocent people? Well, in the first place, we don't know how innocent they were, but that's another question. But nonetheless, there is an answer to it, of course, and so I recall I sat down, took a couple of days, or in fact, just went home that evening and sat down and wrote about a 5-page essay and then printed off 60 or 70 copies and came in the next day and we spent 2 or 3 days discussing that whole point, why, God does allow evil, to happen, why he does allow suffering to happen, sometimes even to innocent people.
So it really, all through history, the greatest minds, Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, and the great theologians and philosophers have tried to talk about how do we reconcile a good God with suffering of innocent people.
Many people have lost their faith because they were not able to satisfactorily answer that question. I remember one case in particular, Albert Camus. Camus was a well-known existentialist philosopher of the mid-20th century, and he was, I believe, a friend, but certainly an associate with Jean-Paul Sartre. But nonetheless, he had, I believe, been raised in Algeria, Camus. And when he was a boy, a young man at least, probably in his teens, he witnessed a tragedy that really shook his faith to the very foundation. He'd been probably raised a Roman Catholic. It was a French, you know, Algeria at that time was a French colony, and so the Foreign Legion, of course, were stationed there to keep peace. And apparently the Foreign Legion got into a shooting battle with some Berber
tribesmen,
and a child got caught in between this crossfire and killed the child. And the mother was holding the child in her arms, weeping, and Camus could not accept that. He just, how could a good God allow such a terrible thing to happen? And he lost his faith over it. Never regained it.
Really?
And probably he tried to, probably one of the reasons he may have become a philosopher was trying to find some kind of philosophical reason, you know, for giving meaning and purpose to our lives, you know, to give us some kind of hope or something for life, for living.
So undoubtedly, we can talk about the mystery of suffering, but we can't always give complete and satisfactory answers in every circumstance. I remember a woman whose mother died in a very painful death of cancer. And she said to me, because they were Catholic, now if God were good, how could he possibly have stood by and let this happen? And the only answer I told her, I said, I really don't know, but I guess the only thing we can do now is look at the cross, look at the crucifix, and God stood by when his own son died on the cross. He was the most innocent of all, but he did draw great good out of it. So somewhere we have to keep our faith, even though we're in the darkness. And that's probably the answer that we have to keep giving. We don't know completely the answer.
Well, I think up to a point we can give several reasons for that. One is, I know there are a lot of theologians and people today don't believe this is true anymore, but I strongly do, that God it's one way he allows us to be punished for our sins.
Okay.
Jesus, you know, and particularly in the Gospel of Matthew, he speaks far more of the pains of hell than he does about the glories and pleasures of heaven. And certainly that's one reason. I think another reason is to test our love and devotion to him. All you have to do is read the book of Job if you want to find out what that story is all about.
That's the book in the Old Testament that talks about why does a good man suffer, there's all kind of people are trying to answer
yes.
that.
And they never did really resolve the issue completely, because in the Old Testament there really wasn't a complete 100% satisfactory answer. It wasn't until the New Testament, until Christ came into the world with his revelations and his life, of course, that we could finally get the definitive answer about that. There's another reason. It's suggested already in what we've been saying. God allows suffering or evil in the world to allow us to play a role in the redemption, that is, by redemptive suffering.
Doesn't Paul say, I make up in my body what is lacking to the sufferings of Christ?
Yes.
And it's a very mysterious statement, but it certainly ties in that whole idea of that we try to cooperate in the and offer our sufferings with the sufferings of Jesus.
And another reason is to bring us back to God. People tend to, you know, when their life turns sour, when things go bad, sometimes they do go to their knees, come back to God. And certainly 9/11, you might recall, the whole country, people started going to church, at least for, at least for about a month, anyway.
Right.
And there was a big surge of religious fervor there for a while. Unfortunately, it wasn't very lasting, and I quite frankly didn't expect it would be at the time, but at least for a while it brought man, at least the Americans, to their knees.
Well, and the perfect example in the New Testament is the prodigal son. He has nothing to eat. His friends have run out on him because his money is gone. And he said, I'll go back and just ask for a job in my father's farm.
Yeah, things got about as bad as they could for him. He was suffering about as much as
someone could. But it was the thing that brought him.
Yeah.
In fact, the gospel says, and coming to his senses,
yeah.
He had been acting crazy when he was in out there in the world of sin.
One other reason I like to mention, and this is probably one of the most important ones, if not the most important, is God allows suffering or evil in the world to bring good from evil. And that's an old saying. I think it even goes back to St. Augustine probably, maybe even before that. But in regard to this, God never permits evil except to bring good from it. The Catechism says that, quote, in time we can discover that God is, in his almighty providence, can bring a good from the consequences of an evil, even a moral evil, caused by his creatures. It was not you, said Joseph to his brothers, who sent me here, but God. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. It'd take a while to explain, you know, the context of that story, but...
Well, and of course his brothers had sold him,
yes,
out of jealousy into slavery, and then he rose to power in Egypt, and they came down looking for grain, and they have to come to Joseph.
And he was able to save them.
He was able to save them.
Provide them with food and what have you. The Catechism goes on to say that, quote, from the greatest moral evil ever committed, the rejection and murder of God's only Son, caused by the sins of all men, God by his grace, that abounded all the more, that you just quoted that a while ago, in fact, abounded all the more from Romans 5:20, brought the greatest of goods, the glorification of Christ, and our redemption. But for all that, evil never becomes a good. So that's the final part. In other words, God allows evil to bring good, but evil itself, of course, is never, you know, a good thing. It's an evil thing. Elsewhere, the Catechism states, quote, but why did God not permit the first man from sinning?
Prevent the first man from sinning?
Yes.
Okay.
Why did God allow sin in the first place? Why did he allow evil to even enter into the world in the first place? I mean, he could have kept it, but obviously this would have violated man's free will.
Okay.
St. Leo the Great responds, and we're still quoting from the Catechism here, Christ's inexpressible grace gave us blessings better than those the demons' envy had taken away. And St. Thomas Aquinas wrote, there is nothing to prevent human nature being raised up to something greater, even after sin. God permits evil in order to draw forth some greater good. Thus St. Paul says, we're still quoting from the Catechism, where sin increased, there's your quotation, grace abounded all the more. And the exultant sings, I think this is one of the Psalms, O happy fault which gained for us so great a Redeemer. This is found in the Catechism. So the Catechism is here referring to the sin of Adam and Eve, of course, but the quote is quite applicable to actual sin as well, and not just simply to original sin.
I've often thought on Easter night, Easter Saturday night, when they have this big lighted Easter candle and they're singing this exultet, how the world exalts the resurrection of Jesus. And that statement is often quoted down through history, oh, happy fault of Adam and Eve. And when we think of all the tragedies that came from it, it's almost a paradox. Obviously, in the context of which is being said, God drew so much good out of it by sending his Son and Jesus dying on the cross for us. So it was a happy fault, even though it was the biggest fault in our history of humanity.
Well, a number of years ago, one of my middle school students, when I was teaching in the middle school religion, very perceptibly said in response to this very question, or this very, why did God allow evil, you know, to enter into the world? And the student said, well, perhaps God allowed Adam and Eve to sin because it gave him a chance to redeem us, in order to show his infinite love for us, to show how much he loves us.
Boy, that's a deep perception for a middle school.
Yes, it is.
Middle school student.
Well, this is the ultimate example of God causing good to result from evil. The greatest good of all time, that is the redemption of mankind, resulted from the worst evil of all time, that is the fall of mankind, and certainly the suffering and death of God's Son on the cross. So God let Adam and Eve sin so that he could one day show the human race how much he loved them by sending his only begotten Son into the world to suffer and die for their salvation, or our salvation. One of the classrooms at John Paul II Catholic High School has displayed on the top of the bulletin board, it goes something like this: the worst thing that ever happened, that is, the suffering and death of Jesus, is the best thing that ever happened for us.
Oh, that's a nice statement. I didn't realize that was down there.
It's in one of the classrooms.
Okay. Well, since our time is kind of running out on us, we got a little more time. We've discussed the reasons that we can come up with, and they're good reasons, that we God permits evil so that good can come out of it. But as we come to the bottom line, isn't it really still a big mystery?
Oh, yes. Still, the ultimate reason God permits evil remains, for the most part, a mystery. And in this regard, the Catechism, let's quote from the Catechism, see what it says about this. Quote, "The fact that God permits physical and even moral evil is a mystery that God illuminates by his Son, Jesus Christ, who died and rose to vanquish evil. Faith gives us the certainty that God would not permit an evil if he did not cause a good to come from that very evil, by ways that we shall fully know only in eternal life." End of quote. Elsewhere, the Catechism says, quote, "We firmly believe that God is master of the world and of its history, but the ways of his providence are often unknown to us. Only at the end, when our partial knowledge ceases, when we see God face to face," that is, of course, they're talking about the beatific vision, "will we fully know the ways by which, even though the dramas of evil and sin, God has guided his creatures to that definitive Sabbath rest for which he created heaven and earth." End of quote.
That's a beautiful quote summarizing that God can and does draw good out of evil. Catherine of Siena, one of my favorite doctors of the church, who was canonized, or who was declared a doctor in 1970 by Pope Paul VI, said very simply, "I know God the Father, I know God, my Father knows everything, he can do everything, and he loves me, so why should I worry?" And that's, I've always tried to go back to that, because those are fundamental great theological revelations in the Bible, but it's sure hard when I'm under pressure to try to get that not only into my head but into my heart, so I can live that way, that for those who love God, as St. Paul says, all things work together to good, and Teresa of Lisieux says, everything is a grace. Well, I believe those things, but I still have to pray for the grace to be able to put them into my life.
It's interesting that just a few years after that, John Paul declared St. Teresa of Lisieux, you just mentioned, a doctor of the church.
That's right.
The third woman. The first, of course, was St. Teresa of Avila. And all of them for basically the very topic we've been talking about in this series. That's why we quoted them so much, is because of their spiritual writings.
Wonderful. Well, our time is running out. The sands are going through the hourglass of time. So we'd like to say, may God bless you always and in all ways to our listeners, and hopefully we'll be back again at our next session.